This is episode number 55 of DevOps Paradox with Darren Pope and Victor Farsik. I am Darren.
And I'm Victor.
And today we have a guest with us. Victor, do your job.
Ah, okay. I thought that you meant that I'm a guest. We have Carlos Sanchez. He's, I don't know, what is he? He's wasting time in different companies. And now he's...
Wasting time in different companies?
Yes, I mean, wasting company's time.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why they employ him, though. I thought it would be interesting to bring him in because he knows Kubernetes. He runs it at scale. He can tell us about, what caused you pain yesterday, Carlos?
Well, first, thank you for having me. Such a great intro. I love it. It's fantastic. I think it's the best one I ever had, almost. Well, what causes me pain every day? Kubernetes causes you pain. It's just this love and hate relationship.
Shall we get rid of it then?
Probably not until we find something else that gives us less pain.
Okay. So it really depends on the point of reference, what the pain is.
Yes. There's other things that will give you more pain than that. I mean, remember DCOS, Mesos.
Oh, yeah.
That was...
Why are you doing that? I had to go to a therapy for months to forget it, and now you're bringing it back.
Yeah. We tend to forget things that are painful and or remember them as some... this nice thing that was there, but not Mesos.
So what is something that's painful today for you, just in general?
Well, I think it's a lot of times it's just lack of automation. As you keep running more and more things on Kubernetes, you're going to spend time automating things the right way. And the first times you do something new, it takes some toll, let's say. And moving things to Kubernetes makes you rethink how you're doing things. You have to change things and implement them in different ways. So it requires some serious work.
When you say automation, are those the things that before Kubernetes we had automated, or simply we never thought about automating those things before Kubernetes?
Yeah, we have some automation before, and then you have to think about automated things in Kubernetes, then you have to write new stuff, right? You have to, create new Helm charts, create new pipelines that deploy Docker images and then deploy to Kubernetes and then deploy to multiple clusters inside Kubernetes. So it's definitely new stuff that you have to prepare.
Can I assume then that you're not just lifting and shifting things to Kubernetes?
Not just.
Thing. That's a popular choice.
I think that was the big benefit of Kubernetes and Docker, right? It was, I can take whatever I was running before. I just package it in a Docker container and throw it to Kubernetes. And now suddenly I have like a HA legacy application that I don't have to worry about when it dies or something. And it gets automatically restarted and moves around in the cluster. I mean, I think that's what made it really, really popular.
Yeah, but the problem I have with that is that there are obvious benefits of just putting your stuff, whatever it is, wherever it was, into Kubernetes, and you get HA and all the good stuff, right? But on the other hand, I have impression that's a good excuse for people just to keeping the old stuff as is. Kind of, it's almost like preventing you from, when you do those small improvements, it often prevents you from actually doing the right thing, whatever the right thing is. Oh, I can lift a shift and suddenly I don't actually, the problem I had is not a problem anymore.
Yeah, it's the, the long-standing issue of, you know, how much time do I spend and how much value do I get in return, right?
Exactly.
And greenfield versus brownfield, and obviously everything new, you do it thinking on Kubernetes and multi-tenant and multi-region and a lot of this new, I mean, all the capabilities, cloud native, that everybody loves to say today. But there's a lot of existing stuff that you could just not throw away, right?
Yeah, that's true. But then why not keep that stuff as is? That's the doubt that I have, kind of like, so I want to move mainframe to Kubernetes, then why?
Well, for me, I think it's a lot of on-premise customers that want to move to cloud. Well, they actually don't want to move to cloud. They want somebody else to run their stuff for them. So it's a move towards SaaS type of solutions, right? So you're a customer, you have something on-premise, you realize it's a lot of pain and a lot of trouble or a lot of work for to maintain and to upgrade and to do all these operations that we needed to do in the past. Today, there's options to not do that. So you ask companies and products to be SaaS. And everybody's now kind of bought into the SaaS model. Nobody's that as afraid as they were before to run something in the cloud. So I think that's the motivation for people to move on-premise stuff to cloud.
Well, what if they're not willing to even move on cloud? What if they're wanting just to stay on-prem? Why would they even want to bring Kubernetes in-house?
Well, as probably Victor already said before, sometime companies may die. That's fine.
There's nothing wrong with it.
It's called, yeah, what was it? Yeah, survival is optional, right?
Exactly.
I don't know. I mean, there's, I think we changed, luckily, in the last 10 years, we changed from, you know, you have to justify moving something to cloud to you have to justify running something on-premise.
I wish that was true.
I mean, there's some things, obviously. There's a lot of people are really picky about some special software or like your source code, your build tools. You don't want that. Somebody else's computers. But everything else, everything that you buy or you subcontract or something, you don't want to run it yourself. More and more.
Yeah, see, I've got two clients right now that are wanting to take everything out of cloud and bring it back on-premise. As you're listening to this, it's May 13th. The reason why they're wanting to bring it in on-premise is because they want to quit spending money. And they have excess capacity laying around in their data center.
What if they didn't have that capacity to start with?
Well, their plan was just to go buy more machines because more machines would be cheaper than what they're spending in cloud.
But actually, that is, I do think that that's true. Cloud is extremely expensive if you do it, if you use it in exactly the same way as you use on-prem, and if you still maintain all the people that you were maintaining when you were managing it on-prem. Of course, it's more expensive.
Well, I think Quinnipiac was the one that said this before, and I think he's pretty right about it. You don't pay AWS or any other cloud company for what you run. They're making money out of what you forgot to turn off.
Exactly. I like that one.
So this infinite capacity thing, which is not infinite, we already saw that happening these last months with COVID and everything that is happening, that comes at a cost that people just run stuff and don't turn it off.
But that brings me I think that that's a similar situation like with Kubernetes, that I hear a lot of people complaining kind of like, oh, Kubernetes is much more complicated than what I had before. Just like cloud is more expensive than what I had before. And at the same time, ignoring that they are now doing stuff that they couldn't do before. Kind of like, yes, now cloud is more expensive because suddenly I can and I do run 100 times more machines.
Yeah, it's the same thing with, you know, PCs that were, oh, now I buy a PC that's twice as fast as my previous one, and now the applications take twice as much CPU, right?
Exactly.
That's what happens.
That's a good one.
So today, you're running Kubernetes at scale. Give us a sense of what's, without real numbers, without saying who you work for, which we're not going to do, but what is scale to you? Is it multi-cluster, right? That's a fair assessment.
Yeah, I think there's, and I learned more and more about this in the last months, you know. I don't think you can run Kubernetes as one cluster only, unless you have extremely low profile.
What do you mean by low profile?
Small profile, yeah. Small profile.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, small as in, you know, I don't know. I wouldn't run clusters with more than, I don't know, 300 nodes, 400 nodes. I wouldn't do that. There is a limit, there's some limitations on Kubernetes on how far you can, your cluster can go. But then you have also the limitations of everything you run on Kubernetes, right? There you have now service meshes, the networking layers, you have the persistent volumes, you have all these different things. And those will impose other different limits than just per Kubernetes, right? So as soon as you start adding things into the mix, they come with their own limits, and they hit those limits at different points in time. That's one reason. Other reason that I learned in the last two companies I worked for is that you don't want to run all your production clusters in the same accounts on your cloud providers, because there's like API request limits, and then you get throttled if you go through those, and then all your production stuff goes down or has issues, and whether it's production or it's development or staging or whatever, you have to spread things across multiple cloud accounts. Otherwise, that would be your single point of failure, not Kubernetes or anything else. So API request limits is a big one. And then you want to run across multiple availability zones, of course, that you could do with one cluster, but then you probably want to run in different regions for latency. And also lack of capacity. That's what's happening now with the coronavirus situation. Europe is having more issues getting resources. Microsoft announced, like in Azure, they were going to cut off some free accounts getting different types of VMs because there's not enough capacity for them in Europe. And that keeps you, I mean, that brings you to realize that maybe it's not just one cluster, three availability zones in one region. Now you have to consider these things for, I don't know, like disaster recovery or growth planning.
How ready are we as industry, not your company, my company, but in general, kind of how mature is that to begin with? Is it a valid expectation to say, go run in multiple clouds, in multiple regions, and all that stuff?
No, I don't think it is like running multiple clusters. I mean, you don't have to do it. It depends on your use case. But you have to be aware of the risks you're taking, right? I mean, you can run everything in one availability zone. You just need to be aware of the risk that AWS goes down in that availability zone, which is very low and maybe enough for you, depending on the cost associated, right?
I was more referring kind of like as in solutions that we have right now for multi-cluster, multi-region. What is that these days? Mostly Istio-based something?
No, not even that, because then I think the ideal world where your Kubernetes cluster just transparently runs across multiple regions, that's not... I mean, that may exist today, but the reason you're moving to multiple regions is because you want to avoid single point of failure. So the last thing you want to do is to run something across multiple regions, because that then becomes your single point of failure, at least today. So I don't think there's good tools today to allow us to run like Kubernetes, multiple regions, multiple clusters in a like transparent way.
Right, because that's interesting that you just brought that up, because even though you're wanting to run multiple clusters through a single pane of glass, you still state that that's a single point of failure, because there could be a cascading effect in case one region went down, you had them tied together, the other one could go down, done incorrectly.
Yeah, that could happen. I mean, there's some tools that are trying to bring back this, what was the... there was a Kubernetes project to do this multi-cluster thing. That may happen, but I don't know yet if any of the tools that are out there kind of works.
And from your perspective, running multiple clusters isn't that big of a deal. It's a deal.
It is a deal, yeah.
It's a trade-off,
yeah.
But that trade-off is what it is today. I mean, because we don't have that good answer today.
Yeah, obviously, I would love to have some tool that allows me to manage multiple clusters in multiple regions and do it in a nice way, so I don't have to do it. I mean, the other reason to go with multiple clusters is that you want to do progressive delivery of your upgrades. So the...
What is progressive delivery, Carl?
What is progressive delivery? That's a great question.
So we're laughing. So you have to tell the story right now to understand what progressive delivery... You're going to tell what progressive delivery is, but tell the backstory of where that came from.
Oh, well, I've been talking about progressive delivery for a while. This is a term that started with Launch Darling. I think that's the first documented mention. And also James Governor took the term, and I love the term, so I totally stole it. And I gave some talks about progressive delivery, canary deployments, rolling updates, these type of things. So that's what I've been working on.
So what is progressive delivery now? Okay, you told the backstory, now.
Right. Progressive delivery is a new term, because we love having new terms for existing things, that basically puts together a number of techniques that that allow you to do new deployments or delivery, continuous delivery, in a way that it doesn't affect all your running customers, let's say, at once. So things like blue-green deployments, canary deployments, rolling upgrades, feature flags. These all come into the progressive delivery umbrella. So you can deploy to production users, but not all of them at once. So you want to progressively do it in production. So it's not about doing tier-like development staging in production. you want production users to access new features, new deployments, new whatever you build, new features basically, and you want them to expose them in a controlled way, just a few at a time, or a region at a time, or a percentage at a time. This is what Facebook, Netflix, all these big companies do. Because when you test something, you are only testing for stuff that you know that may break. So when you expose production users to these new features, they will, I mean, you're gonna get real valuable input on what this, whether these features work or not.
So you're not saying that we need to eliminate lower environments. They're fine to be there, but we're trying to get through them as fast as possible to get to production.
Yes.
So it can really start testing.
Yes. It's like testing in production. It's a great way to say it. And so you need to have monitoring. Obviously, it's not free for all. You have to have monitoring, you have to have alerts, you have to have a bunch of things because you don't want to break your users, right?
Right. So basically you're saying we actually have to do our jobs and do work in order to attain this.
Yes. Oh. And based on the, I mean, there's a lot of reports like the DevOps report, the Dharma, what's Dharma report? The fastest you get something to production, the less rate of errors and you're going to get and the faster, I mean, the faster your company will be. So you want, if I write some new feature, I want that feature to get to reach the user as fast as possible. There's going to be some tests that obviously have to run because you don't want to break something. Then you're going to use feature flags, you're going to use canary deployments to get that to a number of users. Those may be your internal users first, or beta users, or some specific percentage of the population or a region that you want. And then you may monitor and make sure that that's working fine before rolling it out to everybody else.
Did you say initially that progressive delivery would be one of the reasons to have multiple clusters? Or did I misunderstand?
Well, when you upgrade Kubernetes, and not only Kubernetes, but everything that you're running on Kubernetes, which, again, is all the networking things, your ingress controllers, your, I don't know, persistence controllers, everything that you run, you don't want to upgrade everybody at the same time. So you have multiple clusters, you can have staging clusters, but again, it's the same thing as when you are deploying code. It's just infrastructure. You can test it in staging, but maybe you don't catch a problem until you deploy to production. If all your customers are in the same cluster, or all your users are in the same cluster, then you have a problem.
Well, I think one of the examples right now is Google is rolling out Meet to Mail. Like I saw it in the corporate account this week, or late last week, one or the other. And in my personal Google account, my Google Apps account, it showed up today. Right. So now I've got Meet that shows right up in my mail account that I've never seen before. So this is progressive that, okay, this is a feature. Let's roll it out to our paying clients first. And then let's roll it out to the people that don't pay us any money, but still tend to leech off of us. And they get it last.
So what you're saying with that is that Google is adopting strategy. Let's first experiment on paying customers. And then if they're fine with it, we're going to give it to those who are not paying. That sounds like the opposite logic of what I would do, Carol.
Well, I'm assuming that that's what happened. But, you know, because right now, getting Meet into the hands of corporate people are probably higher than people that aren't corporate. Right, the use case is fine, but it's what it is, right?
I mean, you need, for that, yeah, definitely you need feature flags and stuff like that, because Google, I don't know, you know, tomorrow they may decide to kill it, and then they have to remove it from everybody.
Right.
So maybe actually Google never killed anything, but they just put things under feature flags, and everything still lives somewhere.
Like Google, like Reader?
Exactly.
No, I think Google Plus really died. I don't think it's ever going to come back. So.
Or Wave.
Or Wave, yeah. Boy, I'd forgotten about Wave. See, there we go.
Hangouts.
Well, that's just a... Okay, let's not go there. The list is too long. So, multi-cluster, progressive delivery. What else are you working on that you can talk about? That you're finding interesting, that you're finding challenging?
Batch scripting. That's the most challenging part.
Say that again?
Bash scripts.
Bash scripts. Why is that the most challenging part?
Well, you don't know how hard it is until you try.
Sorry, one of those cases where you have shell scripts that are thousands of lines of...
No, not really. I mean, I've been writing bash scripting more than I wanted to for the last years. At the end, you have to automate things, right? At some point, you're like, oh, I'll just write a bash script for this and that, and then, you know, deploying to Kubernetes or creating something in Kubernetes or whatever. And you have all these pieces together today, and you just need to write glue between them. A lot of times, it's just bash scripts. I mean, you have containers that do some initial thing, and it's just bash script running on a container. So I've seen that for a while now.
So are you saying that bash scripts do not scale?
Oh, wow, so script scales perfectly. As long as you put it in a Docker container and then run it to Kubernetes.
Okay. So it sounds like your pain has been on the other side of that.
No, I mean, you have... I'm serious about the glue stuff. I mean, you have all these tools. Now you have to deploy things and put together, I don't know, when you want to start a Docker container that has something in it and you install packages, then you create a script that starts whatever. Then you create other things that glue all this stuff together. I mean, you want to get the statistics out of a cluster. I mean, you can write programs, you can write shell scripts, you can write Python, Golang, whatever. But you need to write... There's a lot of stuff that you need to write to glue together, you know, your clusters, your monitoring, your resources. I mean, that gets better and better with time.
That's kind of...
Everybody's writing their own thing. I think there's no like, oh, this is the way you get... I don't know, your whole ecosystem of things that you need to run Kubernetes in production. Here it is, just run this and it will all work.
That's maybe kind of a problem compared to, you know, like 20 years ago, we were all using a single big something from somebody. From IBM provided a whole solution, or Oracle, or whomever. And now we are in that different extreme that it's so segmented, the whole ecosystem, that just figuring out what you're going to use from 75 different vendors is probably already a year of your life or something like that.
Oh, it's very easy. You just have to go to the CNCF poster of projects, and you just pick one.
One for each type of task.
Well, actually, you have to pick all of them at the same time.
Exactly. Kind of, you cannot use CNCF without adopting all of them. What's the point?
Same thing with the CDF, isn't it?
With CVS?
CDF.
Ah, CDF. Continuous
Delivery Foundation.
Yeah, we don't have that problem because there are only five of them to pick from. While in CNCF, you have 100 or more. I don't know anymore.
More.
But yeah, it's... I honestly don't understand how people who did not spend 5 years with Kubernetes are managing to figure it all out.
I mean, I think everybody's writing their own Grafana dashboards, their own queries in Prometheus, their own. I mean, at least now it's kind of standardized the stack for monitoring.
Yeah,
monitoring is. But yeah, but, you want to know, oh, I want to know how many, I mean, how much resources are we using in these clusters per pod and per container and per namespace? I actually had to write a kubectl plugin for that.
And it's kind of potentially dangerous because at least the last years, what I've been seeing, it's getting better, but it's still not far from that, is that people invest a lot of time and effort into something, and then a year after, somebody else comes. Are you still really using that? That thing is not valid anymore. We killed it already half a year ago.
Isn't
7 months after it was created. Yeah.
Isn't that what you do every month?
Exactly. Exactly. Now, if you don't have a monthly rewrite of everything, you're in deep trouble.
I'll blame it on people that keep writing books every month.
Yeah, I don't know any. I mean, if you're referring to me, I need 4 months.
Maybe let's stop there, because that's a painful topic right now.
Yeah.
Multi-cluster or multi-Kubernetes clusters, progressive delivery, no big deal. I have to rewrite a book every month? Nope. Nope, that's a little too close to home. Every 4 months. All right, so... Well, cool, Carlos. Thanks for hanging out today. Sort of cut us off. You always come back. In fact, we'll probably invite you back for one of our Friday live streams or Thursday live streams or whenever our live streams happen based on day job work.
Okay, maybe Victor. It's going to be hard for Victor to come up with a better introduction than today, but.
I'll work on it. This time it was ad hoc. I will think for a few
You'll have it scripted.
I will have it scripted, yes. I don't know yet what it will be, but it will contain the word magnificent in the introduction. That's a promise.
And also remember with the live stream, I'm not as concerned. I'm concerned, but I'm not as concerned about your actual swearing. So you could actually go a little more wild on the live stream. If we pre-record it, that's different. Live stream, hey, all bets are off.
Yeah, I'm using it to my advantage. I know that you cannot censor me in live stream.
Exactly.
So I can do whatever I want. And it has effect.
It does have an effect. I'm not going to say whether it's positive or negative, but it does have an effect. If you are listening via Apple Podcasts today, go ahead and please subscribe and leave a rating and review. All of our contact information, including Twitter and LinkedIn, can be found at devopsparadox.com/contact. And if you'd like to be notified by email when a new episode is released, you can sign up at devopsparadox.com. The sign-up form's at the top of every page. There are also There are links to the Slack workspace, the Voxer account, and how to leave a review in the description of this episode. At some point, I'm going to make that much shorter and much more cool. It'll have music, but not today. Because Victor has corrected me. Work on one thing till you get it done. I have one thing I have to get done by Sunday. And then I can start the other fun stuff that I want to do. That sucks, Victor.
What?
I don't know how you keep doing that.
Giving you advice.
You're giving me advice that I'm trying to adhere to, but it's not fun.
You know, you got
it for free?
You want
that advice? You got the advice for free? I had to pay him.
Yeah, no, it's like drugs. First time is for free.
So it's free.
Until you get hooked.
Okay. So quick recap for Carlos. Carlos, how can people reach out and contact you? Twitter best way or LinkedIn or?
C. Sanchez.
C. Sanchez.
Yes.
On Twitter. Okay, C. Sanchez. I'll make sure that's down in the description of the episode as well. And then you can go bug Carlos over there and ask him about how do I progressively deliver a multi-cluster Kubernetes? How do I deliver a multi-Kubernetes cluster across multiple things? And by the way, I need that in 10 words or less. Thanks. I need to turn this report in.
You could just come to KubeCon and listen to him explain it.
Yeah, I wouldn't bet on that happening this year, but we'll see.
Do you have any? So I know, Carlos, you've done quite a few conferences over the years. Are you lined up to do any virtuals near term?
Yeah, there is several conferences planned, but for some reason they get delayed, and they're planning to do them at the in the last quarter of the year. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. I wouldn't bet on that either. But
well, our friends over at SNCC, Patrick Dubois, pulled one off a few weeks ago. That was pretty darn amazing in the amount of time that he had to pull it together. So hats off to Patrick. I'd like to get him back on and get a postmortem of what were you thinking and how did you do it?
Yeah, that was great. I watched some of the sessions. It's just hard to find time now to go through all of them. But for me, the online conference kind of misses the... I mean, for me, the conference is all about the traveling and the meeting people in person. So that's
and we're not going to be doing that anytime soon.
And in a way, being forced, I don't know, maybe it's only me, but you know, when it's online, then, oh, I can see it tomorrow. And then tomorrow is always tomorrow.
Yeah.
Well, kind of, if you're in a conference, kind of, so either I go and listen to that talk or I just sit in a hallway.
Yeah, you don't have time to watch conference between the yoga, making your own bread, you know, reading the books, stuff.
Or in my case, editing courses. So, all right. Carlos, thanks for hanging out today.
Thank you.
Victor, have a wonderful rest of your day. And for everybody else listening, thanks again for listening to episode number 55 of DevOps Paradox.